This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles, and I'm joined this week by Jonathan Bennett when we interview Kalia Young on the subject of digital identity. That's coming up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 586, recorded Wednesday, July 8th, 2020, Digital Identity. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/floss. And by Hover. Do you have a domain name that truly represents you and your passion? Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire year. Hi, everybody. I'm Doc Searles. I'm joined this week by Jonathan Bennett, my co-host, and we're going to be visiting with Kalia Young, who's an old friend and colleague of mine. So, Jonathan, you familiar with Kalia and her work at this point?
Hey, Doc. I'm only familiar with it because of doing a little bit of prep for the show. But I tell you what, boy, it's some interesting things it looks like that she's working on and thinking about.
Yeah, she's I think she's the most important person in the whole identity world, such as it is. There's so many spinning worlds going on out there. You're physically in Oklahoma still?
Yes, down in the southwest corner of the state.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have been relocated to San Marino, California, which is kind of the other South Pasadena near Los Angeles, and I'm hoping that this mic doesn't fall down because it's taking me a long time to set this up in a room full of antiques that wasn't meant for this. I don't mean to join one of those antiques. So before we jump into a talk with Kalia, I want to we got to pay for this, and so I'm going to go to our first ad. And so this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Barracuda, the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Suddenly, you have dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of employees working remotely. Each one of those are getting tons of emails every day, making them vulnerable. 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email, spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. You multiply that by how many employees, right? That times how many emails. One click on the wrong one can cost you money, customers, and reputation. Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. So get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection, which includes all-in-one email security, backup and archiving, AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise, an automatic incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks, security awareness training to educate your workforce so your employees could be the first line of defense against attacks. There are so many experiences we've had. I get this all the time. I mean, how many spear phishing attacks any of us get? We get so we see them instinctively, but we really need better help than that. So right now, there are new attacks impersonating organizations like the World Health Organization. Attackers utilize domain spoofing and promise information relating to the coronavirus in an attempt to trick users into a phishing scam. So ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure, free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/floss. That's barracuda.com/floss. Barracuda, your journey secured. Okay, so Kalia, you're there, I assume. bring your face up. Hi. I want to so welcome. And by the way, she's just got the best camera. We checked this out ahead of time, and it was actually that camera was tested at a conference we put on together called the Internet Identity Workshop. We had our 30th one just a few weeks ago, and none of that would have happened, I think, if I hadn't met Kalia. I was involved in the identity world, in the identity conversation, as they say, at giving the closing keynote to a lot of an identity conference that was always cynical. And I had actually given up on the whole thing as a topic when I find myself sitting at a Giants game in San Francisco next to this woman working on a laptop. I asked what she was doing, and it was Kalia. And what began then was her turning me around and making me optimistic about what could be done with identity. Since then, we've not only started the Internet Identity Workshop, but had Kalia's written two books, and probably I think she knows more and is a more important actor in the whole, in all of development around identity in the world. And it's just a real pleasure to have her on the show. So let me just start out by asking, you're doing everything right now. What's sort of front and center for you in the world of changing the world to make it safe for identity?
Right. What am I doing? Well, a lot of my work is stewarding the communities. So you and I organize an event twice a year that brings together a whole range of working groups and communities, right? So in between those events, there's a whole bunch of different venues where people are meeting to continue ongoing work. And so I'm participating actively in some of those groups, but I'm tracking a whole range of them. And yesterday I just did convening work around supporting leadership in different organizations across the whole community, meeting each other because they actually didn't know each other. And so I brought that meeting together and facilitated it to support, the different executive directors on, of which there are many working in identity organizations, getting to know each other. So it's connecting and information sharing work as well, because that's, if you believe in self-organization, then the glue for self-organization is information.
Hey, Kalia, I'll jump in if I can. It's wonderful to meet you and to get to talk to you. Before we jump into identity and open source and all of those things, I've got to ask, what camera is it that you're using? That does look really good.
Yeah. So one of the participants at IIW had this set up. It's a Sony A6000 with some specific lens. I just followed the instructions because I just released my book. And there will be no book tour that is in person. And I decided that spending as much on a camera setup as I would on a couple plane flights to go on a virtual book tour was worth it.
That totally makes sense. And boy, I suppose it's an interesting time to be talking about identity on the internet when, we're in the middle of this crisis and all of our interactions now, it seems like, are either over the phone or over the internet. That's got to be interesting when you're thinking about this topic, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely put our work more front and center. The need to be able to prove things about yourself without showing pieces of paper in person has accelerated, right? So the good news is that the technologies around decentralized identity and self-sovereign identity are just at the cusp of being adoptable, right? So the 5 years of really intensive work that we've done to get to the point there's products in market is worth it. And there's still, you know, another intensive couple years to really solidify those products and offerings and make sure different people's wallets are interoperable and different credentials are accepted many more places. But we have the fundamental building blocks we needed to support people owning and controlling their digital representations of themselves and choosing where to share it and not being reliant on like Google or Facebook or any large network or system that assigns you an identity. Instead, with the new decentralized identity, you can generate the key material and stay in control of it and use fancy cryptography to package up verifiable credentials about yourself from other people and share them in ways that are totally different than the current paradigms of how we understand identity working.
Now, let me ask an intentionally naive question. Isn't this a problem that PGP, Pretty Good Privacy, and the GNU Privacy Guard, GPG, didn't those guys solve this years and years ago?
Sure, they solved it for like a bunch of nerdy people who want to like fight with PGP keys every time they interact with their email. And I was also skeptical about these technologies that we've developed in our community. But I was really sold on it when I went to a startup, one of the startups in the community. I went to their offices and I sat down with their CEO and he showed me a mobile app where all of the fancy crypto was there, but it was under the hood. But I, as an individual, was just interacting with like representations of cards in a UX that felt really human and really easy to connect with. Whereas, and you never saw long numbers. So as long as we hide all the long numbers deep in the software, I think we're good. But anything that expected people to interact with long numbers or go look up their friends' keys in some esoteric database,
There's probably an argument to be made that if you entirely hide all of that, and I don't mean make it a requirement for using your identity software, but if you get to the point to where you can't open the hood up and go and look at that, you've kind of got a system where you can't audit it. And so you may have great crypto under the hood, but you really are in a position where you just have to trust the guys that wrote the app that they got everything right. Isn't there something to be said for having the ability to go in and audit that and look at the hard crypto?
Sure, but normal people don't want to do that. I mean, there's two layers of this conversation, right? What is the thing you hand normal humans and expect them to interact with? And what does the software look like deep down? I think it's very likely that we will see a lot of the wallet software be open source for this very reason that you're articulating. But whether the crypto is understanding what the app does and evaluating it from a technical perspective needs to be done by technical people. It's not done by everyday folks, right? So this is where I think like the technology doesn't matter if no one can use it and it doesn't feel human, right? And what it does the code actually do is really important too.
So let's take a step back then and kind of define what exactly are we talking about? And there's kind of I think of it as a buzzword. Self-sovereign identity is what we're talking about. But what does that mean, like on a ground level, somebody using the internet or, you know, maybe even real-world interactions? What is that referring to? What does it look like?
So it means that instead of getting your identity assigned to you by a bunch of structures that look like pyramids, so you can have an account at Google, an account at Facebook, an account at Twitter, an account at LinkedIn. You're interacting in those companies' private namespaces, so you're subject to their terms and conditions, and you can have your identity disappeared by them. You also could get a phone number, right? But that's owned and or it's managed in a global universe. A phone number is managed at the international level in a global registry by the International Telecommunications Union. So you don't own your phone number, and you don't own, you can rent a URL. And in fact, our community back in the day with the first versions of OpenID believed everyone in the world was going to have their own URL. It turns out that the mental models of normal people don't really work in terms of owning URLs as like for them. And that technology was not designed to do that. So SSI breaks all these paradigms in a good way and says, what if the individual on software they own and control generated a decentralized identifier, a public-private key pair that goes with it, and use that decentralized identifier as an anchor for their digital representation? So there is no registry that is assigning you an identifier like you have in those systems I named before, that you're generating your own. So really long numbers you generate by yourself, such as like, you know, as happens with PGP, et cetera, aren't actually interesting in terms of communicating meaningful information about people, right? So with SSI, there's a with decentralized identifiers comes another complementary standard called verifiable credentials. And so those that standard is actually standardized at the W3C, and it's a universal language for anyone to make a credential for anyone for any reason. It's a universal language for credential creation. So it could be everything from super important things like a green card is communicated in a verifiable credential, a driver's license in a mobile credential, a student card communicated in a verifiable credential, a university degree communicated in that, or a tiny little thing like I went to yoga class last night and I got a verifiable credential for coming to class. Or I shop at a store regularly, and instead of like having some account with them with all these loyalty points, they issue me a verifiable credential after I purchase something, and I collect those in my own wallet and bring them back to them, right? So there's ways. So it's really important to understand that the verified and verifiable credentials is about the cryptography, not about the veracity of the claims. That's a whole other set of problems that also has to be solved in this ecosystem of like, was that driver's license really issued to you by the state of California, in my case, where I live? Or was it created by some guy on the internet who claimed he was the state of California? Right? So that is another set of issues that is also being addressed in the community. But the core fundamental verifiable credentials is what presents this huge opportunity for us to now have an ecosystem of credentials, just like we would have in our physical wallets, but in our digital wallets, and be able to share those with other parties in ways that they can believe the claims in them.
So Floss Weekly is a live show. We do take questions from the audience every once in a while. And we have JoJo Dancer who wants to know, what type of encryption are we talking about? What's the speed on doing encryption, decryption on a mobile device? And I'll make this a little bit easier for you to answer if you don't want to get into the nitty gritty of the actual encryption itself. But kind of to broaden that question out, how are these identity, these identifiers, how are they kept safe? So there's two sides to this question. One is, you know, proving that you are you, but the other side of it that I think he's asking about is keeping that information safe from everybody else. How is that accomplished?
So I'm not actually sure I fully understand the question.
Or is it because of the model that's being used? Would it be safe to say that encryption is just it's not an important part of the model because you're already protected by, you know, whatever encryption your phone has by default?
So I think there's just several levels that may be getting confused. So when I get issued a verifiable credential by an institution, That credential is, the claims in it are signed by the issuer, and the issuer has done something. They've posted the decentralized identifier and the associated public keys to some sort of ledger, usually, that can be looked up by a verifier. And so if I take my verifiable credential and I pass it to a verifier, the verifier checks the signature that it lines up. The signature on my verifiable credential that it lines up with the issuer's public key, so that they know it came from that issuer. And the thing that's innovative about this is that it means you can have infinitely scalable low-cost federation. You don't have the issuer and the verifier needing to speak to each other. So I guess the speed of the encryption, like, it's really about the verifier doing the math to figure out whether your credential is real or not. And as far as I know, it's relatively quick. Like, nobody's talking about that being a constraint in the system.
So let's give a real world example, I think, to put meat on this issue. You talked about the idea of, you know, maybe in the future we could have actual driver's license that are stored this way. So when you get pulled over and police officer comes to your window and says, hey, I need to see your proof of identification, all of that. And, you know, whatever digital exchange happens to where, you know, you hand over, this is who I am. According to the state of California, here's my driver's license information. How do we prevent that police officer from also being able to see, oh, this person was at yoga class, and this person, you know, was at the local comic book store, and this person did this and did that and did that? What's the protection from that prevents all of that information from being handed over when it's all, you know, connected to your identification?
Right. So here is a really critical fact. I get to have as many decentralized identifiers as I want, right? There is no limit. So I don't, none of those credentials are linked together. They're also all in my wallet. So I get to choose what I share with a police officer. So I say, I send them a verifiable presentation of my driver's license. They get the proof that I have, I'm in control of that credential. They also can't do a representation attack. They can't pretend they're me because of the way that the credential is presented with the cryptography, that it proves that I have the right signature. It doesn't give the signature away so it can be represented, if that makes sense.
Let me I hope this amplifies or kind of isolates what we're trying to say a little bit. The whole thing is about need to know. In other words, you know, I have a virtual wallet that has credentials in it that I can present on a need to know basis, where the usage is constrained, where there's minimum disclosure for constrained use, to quote Kim Cameron's second law of identity. You know, there's user control. There's minimum disclosure for constrained use. There's justifiable parties. These are things that were thought up almost two decades ago. And this embodies those things. The whole idea behind self-sovereignty is that you have something that actually resembles what happens in the real world, which is are you tall enough to be on this ride? Are you old enough to watch this movie? And you present a verifiable credential that does not uncork a monstrous amount of other information about you. And you know, anyway, so I just wanted to make that clear. And toward the question about crypto, the sessions where the crypto passes are really pretty isolated. It's not like you're having a long communication about something. You're just simply presenting a credential that's encrypted. It gets decrypted, and it doesn't have to be more complicated than that.
Right. You're totally right. And there's a bunch of work going on about how the credentials actually pass. And there's an open standard called DIDCOM. That's still in development, but mostly done because there's working implementations using it, where you use the decentralized identifiers to establish an encrypted channel for the credentials to even be moved along, right? So there's several different places where encryption and cryptography plays a role in these systems.
Yeah, this is great, and I want to get into a little bit more on this, and especially about the standards involved after we go to a sponsor. And so I want to say that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Hover as well. Create a domain name that truly represents you and your brand. Hover has over 400 plus domain name extensions to choose from when building your brand online. No matter what you want to build, there's a domain name for it. And by the way, I have been a longtime customer of Hover. All my domain names are with Hover. I had a bunch with other providers that, including one that I just couldn't pry them away from, and they were hugely helpful in making that all work. They have the best customer service, frankly, I've ever seen. So that's my testimonial, and this is why I'm glad to read this ad. It's a jumping off point for many entrepreneurs. And if you want to start your business with a domain name that truly showcases who you are and what you do, they're incredibly helpful at that. You'll find excellent technical support available to answer any questions you might have. And their support team, this is really critical, never tries to upsell you. You're not. It isn't just an excuse to try and get you to do some other deal. They're always working hard to help you online. So, among other things, they have free Whois privacy protection, a clean and easy to navigate UX UI on their website, monthly sales on popular top level domains. It's not hard to see why Hover is a popular choice for people starting all kinds of businesses. Keeping your domain name separate from hosting, which they don't handle, it gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business, including a host. So use a domain name that truly represents you and your passion. Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And we thank Hover for their support. So Clea, I want to. We've had other conversations about this, but lately you've opened my eyes in a way that I think a lot of our viewers and listeners would like to hear about. We're focused on open source here and on free and open source software, and you're very focused on open standards. And yeah. So I'd like you to unpack, where open source ends and open standards begin, or what do they separately cover, and what can open standards do for us that open source alone cannot?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Doc. So open standards are the building blocks of actually our whole contemporary civilization. We have many of them we don't even think about anymore. So in the physical world, we have standards for measurements, both like distance and weights and volumes. All of those were standardized so that they're not even, to buy and sell goods, we don't have to fight over how we're measuring them because we have this standard to do it with. So that's one way to think about them. In the digital world, the entire stack of the internet is built on open standards, and standards developed in really open processes. So that's, the IETF has incredibly open processes. Anybody in the whole world can join mailing lists that are actively building these standards that create the internet. And they provide these languages for technical systems built by different people to talk to each other. So the examples, that we are all familiar with, no matter how technical we are, is like HTML provides a language for anybody to create a web page in any browser to be able to read it, whether that's open source or not. It turns out that it's a good idea to also have open standards, open source implementations of those open standards. So you have Mozilla and you have Apache and you have like the, the core of Chromium is open. And then you have email, right? So email is an open standard, SMTP. So anybody can send email to anyone and it works, right? So these protocols become really critical to support open communication between technical systems and between it, all the people behind those technical systems in truly open ways. And that's one of the reasons I spent the last 15 years of my life working on supporting the emergence of open standards for digital identity, because I don't believe that it should be owned by anyone, right? That we should have open standards to enable a whole layer of new interactions on top of the internet that we have today that are really empowering for people. And open source alone can't do that. So an example that we talked about coming into the show was Diaspora. So Diaspora was this open source project started by some kids in Queens that got too much attention too fast from the New York Times. And they were sort of just building their own little social thing on their own little island and made it open source. But then so what? Who else does it interact with? Only other people who implement their system? Would it have been a better strategy perhaps to invest in making, you know, in the activity pub work and sort of supporting a whole network of code that could speak a set of protocols around social networking and social exchange of information, right? And I think, you know, people ask me sometimes, like, what would I recommend? I would, like, put a few million dollars into making the open standards around social really work, and then we can, we could potentially disrupt Facebook with them. But just open source code alone isn't going to get us to where we need to go in terms of transforming this people layer of the web.
I mean, the Diaspora example is an interesting one because I had actually kind of half forgotten about it. But the key thing is, and this is the example with email, and also with browsers, they're substitutable. You know, right. Standards make things substitutable, that you can swap one out and swap another one in. You may lose a few features, you may gain a few features, or something like that. But substitutability is one of the key virtues of any software or service. I'm wondering, it might help our viewers and listeners to hear a little bit about how one might get involved in that. Getting involved in an open source project, you go to GitHub, you've got your code base, you jump in on one, you submit a patch or whatever. But the standards thing, which I've only recently become involved with myself, I'm on a working group now, and it is a lot of work. It's a lot of work, you know. I mean, I was just on one this morning that I had to get out of to start this show a little bit on the early side. So, can you tell people a little bit about what kind of how they could jump in on something or even look for something like one might look on GitHub to find a standards thing they might want to
give up. You do look on GitHub to find standards things. Most of the work is actually happening.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Really?
I'm actually co-chair of the Secure Data Store Working Group, which is a joint working group by the Decentralized Identity Foundation and the W3C Credentials Community Group. If you're interested in standards specifically in this space, I'd recommend going. A great friendly place to start. Although, you know, it's friendly, but like it's, you know, it hasn't necessarily updated any of its tools in a while. So, but it's the Credentials Community Group at the W3C is the sort of a great starting point to sort of understand what's happening within the community around standards in the space and to contribute to different work items that they're working on. And to be fair, there's like several phases in the standards process. So the CCG is in the it's in the incubation phase. It's where people have an idea and they want to work with other people and they develop it to the point that it might be ready to become a very formal working group at the W3C. And so far in our community, really only two things have gone to that formal step. One is the decentralized identifier standard, and the other is the verifiable credentials data model. And the next sort of things that are going to get standardized are the exchange of those credentials credentials between wallets, verifiers, like holders, and the individual with the verifiers and the issuers. And but I would say too, there's another strategy with open standards is to wait and adopt, right? So you don't necessarily have to get involved in making them if you don't have something to say about them. But if you do, now's a great time to get involved because they're not all finished. It's like, no, like you can't show up now and like change SMTP because it's done. we're still baking these standards, and it helps if you have your own implementations and you have success in doing something a particular way. The groups are open to learning about that and to putting it into the specifications.
That's an interesting thought, because one of the things that I know I, as an occasional software engineer, kind of frightens me to death is this idea of standards that get developed in a vacuum, or standards developed by some committee somewhere that doesn't have any code running. Sometimes those turn into just ugly, ugly standards that nobody's ever going to use. Or to put it another way, there's too many standards. Nobody's using the same standards. Let's make another one so that we can all get on the same page, right? It's the same problem.
So I think it's a good point to be raising. I think our community is really focused on the best practices around standards development, which is that you have two implementations before you call it done. Two implementations written by different folks, probably in different languages, that are using the standard to communicate between their software. And then it's like, okay, that actually works in the real world. and I think there are standards bodies, for example, that are much older and more conservative that will release standards with no working code, right? And this is sort of the ITUT, like the telephone world is like these... there's different flavors of standards development, and I definitely lean towards the ones that are like, and we need to have at least two implementations working, and one of those should be a reference implementation that's open source, right?
Mm-hmm. So speaking of this idea, is this technology, self-sovereign identity and the things around it, is it usable now? Are there clients out there now that someone could download and generate their own? You know, obviously we talked about how it's going to be a simple process for the end user. Yeah. But is it usable now that you could generate your own keys and then start signing onto websites that way?
So I would point folks at a company called Trinzic. They have a good set of they have implementations that are working. There's actually a code base if folks really want to go the open source direction. There's a project called Ares that's has a lot of momentum and energy around their code bases in this space. And you definitely can download it and play with it and get it running. Large-scale real-world implementations are in the works, but they're not here yet, right?
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, how is this different? I don't remember the name of the company you said. What company was that has a working implementation again?
Trinzic. They're good to, if you're a software developer and want to like pick up some code and experiment, they have opportunities to do that with them.
All right. So what is the difference between using Trinzic for managing your identity and using Google and, OWASP and all of that for managing your identity? Like it just from the outside looking in, it looks like we've got the same thing. We've got a big company that helps you manage your identity and another big company that helps you manage your identity. Like from a rubber meets the road perspective, how is it different?
Right. But so back to the structure, when I use Google to manage my identity, I'm in their infrastructure. Like, well, especially if I have a Gmail account, right? Like I'm literally in their domain name space. with an SSI wallet, and I'm just, you asked for a company. I'm sure there are more out there, and I should put a list on my website that, so like just the generic SSI wallet is something that you download, and you control. And yeah, you have to trust the software maker. And that is an issue, right? But it also can be addressed through things like certification, through consumer reports, through trust marks where folks are having their code evaluated. But the fundamental locus of control for SSI is the individual and their control of the keys, not getting a name from somewhere else and managing it in their universe. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. Let me jump in here for a second. So, it isn't so much the Google universe. So there is in fact is a standard, which is OAuth, and OAuth is what makes possible.
You were saying OAuth. I thought you said OAuth.
You know, I'm saying OAuth. I don't think Jonathan was saying OAuth, but I want to make clear that when you're logging in with Google, you're using OAuth to employ your Google credential. You're not necessarily inside their system. You're just simply using using the OAuth thing.
So this is the difference too. Is like, okay, so the difference between, okay, this is great. The difference between OAuth and logging in with a DID using DDoS is really critical. So in OAuth, when I log into a site with Google or Facebook, the movement, the flow of the transaction for that login is going back to Google and then coming back to the site I'm logging into. So they're leveraging the fact that I logged into Google to sort of do a secondary login to their site. It means Google's in the middle of all transactions I do with OAuth. When I do a DID authentication, I show up and they say, hey, here's my really long number. And they go, sure, prove it to me. And they do a cryptographic challenge to me in my wallet, who takes my private key, signs the challenge, and sends it back to them. And they go, great, now we believe that you are the owner of that really long number. And there was no Google in between me and the site I'm logging into. It's me and my wallet doing the transaction. And then when I show up again, and I say, hey, I'm this really long number again. They do the same cryptographic challenge type thing. And I say, I'm me, and they're great. You're you again. So you don't need any third party to support you in doing logins. You can just do it yourself without a username and password, which is just this huge breakthrough. Like, we don't need them anymore.
That has been a dream come true, or a dream we would like to see come true, which is, it's sort of amazing to me that it's the year 2020. And if you told me in 1995 we would still be using logins and passwords in 2020, I'd be appalled. An interesting thing to me is that both OAuth and these other later things, including SSI, DDoS, to a large degree have been at the very least talked about and moved forward at IIW. And I'd like you to say at least a few words about IIW and what it means, because you mentioned community a few times, and actually IIW is where many communities get together and how communities work. And because you're so instrumental in making all that happen, it wouldn't be there without you. And I'd so like you to say a few words about role of that.
Yeah, so IIW is a really important event. We've been hosting it. You and I are two of the three co-hosts. And what it does is we put up a flag in 2005 and said anybody who's interested in user-centric identity, is what we called it at the time, please come. Right. And so that first IIW, we had presentations for a day. And then I said, hey, let's stay for another day and cross-pollinate and connect all these projects that we had invited to present. And I had participated once in a conference that used this method, and it seemed really perfect, because what happens in using open space technology is everybody who shows up sits in a circle and names the topics that they want to discuss. And then whoever names the topic decides when and where it gets discussed, and other people interested in joining in the conversation about that topic participate. So it's really, it's like open source ethos brought into the conference. So instead of being told from the top down who's going to speak when, the participants themselves, each morning of the event, they decide who's going to present, lead a discussion, whiteboard a challenge, do all sorts of things that are really co-creative with the community that we have brought together. And it moves the industry forward each time. So it's been really powerful place to have new ideas vetted, to have ongoing community work move ahead, to really catalyze the what I would describe now as a really high performance collaboration community that is working really hard to get all the pieces in place. So we have this strong new layer of the internet that works for people. And that was our goal. Our goal was to really figure out the hard technical problems that made that really, that made it not possible in 2005. And it turns out it just took a lot longer than we expected it would. But I think we're really, it's really amazing what's come out of that event. Literally OpenID was invented at the first, like the coalition that would build the first OpenID happened at the very first IAW, the coalition of folks working on OAuth, understood that the password anti-pattern that was being created was toxic for everybody. So at the time, you'd have to ask for people's username and passwords to pull something from one account to another service. And even though people really wanted to keep the photos in Flickr and not let them go to Picasa or whatever, they knew that people would do it anyways and that the password anti-pattern would be toxic to the web unless they built an open standard to allow people to connect accounts at different services. So all of that's come out of IAW. And it's also, you know, if your listeners or those of us watching are like, where do I get involved? Just coming to an IAW is a great place to start because you'll learn so much in 3 days and you'll figure out which projects and topics are most interesting to you. And then you can go hang out with those people for the next 6 months on their mailing lists and their phone calls and their working groups and move the ball forward with them.
So we've only got a few minutes left. This is the point where we ask, what is the question you would like to have been asked by now so you can work it in before we get to the closing ones?
So you could ask, what about your new book, Kalia?
Yeah, here you go. What about your new book, Kalia? What's the name of it? Where do you get it? By the way, we will have show notes. So the book, IAW, Trinsic, Aries, all that stuff, we'll stick in the show notes too.
Yeah, so I just had a book published at the end of June called The Domains of Identity. The subtitle is A Framework for Understanding Identity Systems in Contemporary Society. And I wrote this as my master's report when I graduated from the University of Texas at Austin with a master's in identity management and security. And I wrote this book because I was tired of everybody talking about identity as if it was one big, 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 big problem instead of dividing it up into smaller problems that are nonetheless vast, but less less than infinitely large. So there's 16 domains in the domains of identity. The first one is me and my identity, and then it's a delegation, so people who acting on my behalf in identity systems. There's also, you end up with the data broker industry pulling data from many of the domains and not having a connection with the individual, and you have the illicit market where folks are attacking all of the database systems with our data in it. But it gives a framework for really thinking clearly about identity systems and how they work and what the different components are. Hopefully it'll really move the conversation forward amongst folks who are building tools and systems and government leaders who are making policy, so that we're not trying to regulate the entire universe of all identity at once, and instead of thinking much more in more focused way about, like, what does government registration look like when you get documents from a government where you live, versus what does it look like when you join a soccer team, or what does it look like when you share your identity with your employer and use it to go and do work. These are all involve identity management, but they're just very different domains. So I invite you to get the book, and you can also go to my website and get just a summary of the domains if you want to have a taster before you buy.
Great. I should say, having read the book, it is a canonical work. I think it should be the central text in any conversation about identity, and just a really great work. We have a few questions we generally close with. One is, anything you might have to say about blockchain? That's the sort of our control question for across all of the people who come on the show.
So SSI has uses some little sprinkles of blockchain. It turns out they're really handy places to stash keys for other people to look up if you generated those keys in a decentralized way, right? So all of this stuff about decentralized identity is great, but if I just am when I present my verifiable credentials, the verifier has no way to look up the keys from the issuer, we can't get the system working. So there's several different ledgers and communities using blockchains. One of the code bases is the Indie code base that's used by Sovereign. There's DID-based methods for Ethereum. There's another one called SideTree that works both on Ethereum and on Bitcoin. There's another chain called VerisOne that also supports, you know, the stashing of keys. So there's a whole DID method registry with different blockchains articulating different DID decentralized identifier methods for each of them. So we have lots to say about blockchain in a sort of really narrow way as a place to go and get keys.
And a short final one, because we're coming up on the end of the show. It is. Do you have a favorite text editor and scripting language? This means things to our core audience here.
Yeah. Well, I've learned a little bit about HackMD because we take notes for our SDS working group using it, and I'm gonna go with but I'm a Mac user and I like Pages.
Well, that's an acceptable answer if you can get all the stuff done that you get done. So this has been truly awesome having you on the show, Kalia, and we'll have to have you back. It's been really terrific. So thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks. And if folks have more questions, feel to reach out to me on Twitter, etc.
Yeah. So look at her. She's an identity woman, and that is one of her, probably her best known identities. So, so Jonathan, how'd that go for you? And those are great questions you had too, I thought.
Yeah, I think the different directions that even the two of us went with this conversation is just an indicator of how broad of a topic this is. I mean, there's some rubber meets the road things that we can talk about, and we did. But when you start talking about identity and, you know, people's identity online, you talk about, you know, we could have talked about everything from and I know this is part of her background, is, you know, these web services that say, no, you've got to use your real name versus, no, I want to have a pseudonym because maybe I'm going to, I want to have a pseudonym on Twitter because I'm a conservative, but yet I work in the tech world, you know, things like that. but we didn't even get into that at all. And that's one of the things I was hoping to talk about. But it's just such a broad, broad conversation to talk about what's going on with this area of identity and proving who you are. And one more thing I'll throw in real quick. I have always been skeptical of the idea that we will get away from usernames and passwords. I think that will just always be a part of the landscape. And I know people hate it, but I think it will always be with us.
Well, that's it. You're not alone at that. And I don't think we'll ever get rid of them completely either. And certainly the argument that will stick with it for a long time is a good one because we've been at it forever. And so how long does that go on? I think a key problem with identity is that we, you know, I mean, and this is where I think Khalid was going, and it's certainly where I would want us all to go, which is we don't need to present our identity all the time. We're anonymous for most purposes, and we don't walk down the street wearing a name tag. And we shouldn't have to do that. We should. There's just lots of stuff that people need to know. Other parties need to know. Like, do you have cash on you? Are you old enough to do this? are you tall enough to take the ride? And that's not identity stuff. That's just there's just a whole bunch of other variables that are around identity that aren't identity itself. And the idea behind self-sovereign identity is that the individual is basically in charge of what they present and the circumstances they present it in. But what would happen, and it really happened in the physical world, is that we had wallets and we had a bunch of things in there we called our ID. So somebody would say, I want to see your ID, you know, and you present your driver's license or your passport or your membership card at Costco or some other thing like that. And and that's not your ID, you know. I mean, there's a little confusion around that and about all the stuff that's kind of tied up inside that. But I have to say that I'm actually fairly optimistic. I looked it up yesterday. There's still there's getting close to 500,000 results for self-sovereign identity or SSI. And that's because, as Khalia pointed out, there's just a lot of development going on here. She mentioned a bunch of stuff and you know, our family and my wife is involved with the Sovereign Foundation, which is one of the entities that she mentioned, and the Indie code base, which is at the Hyperledger at the Linux Foundation. But there are others. Ares is there too, I think. But there's so much going on. There's just a lot going on that people could take a look at and see how they could jump in and help out. I'm really optimistic that within the next few years, we're going to change the paradigm for how one presents credentials for constrained purposes. You know, I mean, this is my kid. Okay. That kind of thing. that are completely casual in the physical world, but we haven't worked out yet. I mean, the online world is still new. That's one of my mantras, is that the older I get, the newer it seems.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because and of course I did. I messed up and I said OWASP, but I meant OAuth. But you know, you talk about that and we already have had one paradigm shift with OAuth becoming a thing. And so rather than having to have a separate username and password, essentially a separate identity for every website we go to, now we have OAuth and this ability to tie them all together. But the point then is raised, which is exactly what Khalid was talking about. Do we really want Facebook to be the one in charge of our identity on the internet? And for a lot of us, the answer is no. That's a terrible idea. So I don't know how optimistic I am, because I've seen really cool technologies come and not catch on. But I'm hopeful. Yeah. I think some of the ideas around this project are excellent and needed, and so I'm hopeful that we can get some traction.
That's great. Yeah. I'm in agreement about that too. So I don't. We scheduled a show early this time so we could do a bunch of other stuff. So, and get it out of the way. So is this a good time? This is sort of, I'm asking our management here to break this off and go into and.
But before we do that, can I plug my Twitter account?
Plugs. So yes, absolutely. I'm yeah.
This, all right. If people want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at JP_Bennett, and I do keep that absolutely clear of political things. I've made the decision to not make that a political account. I talk about technology and security there. And then you can follow me over on Hackaday.com. I do a weekly security roundup column, and that goes live generally every Friday morning. So check me out at those two places and say hi.
And I can I just like to plug the Internet Identity Workshop, because we talked about this on the show. Just look it up, Internet Identity Workshop. IIWorkshop.org is a shortcut for that, a short URL for it. It's a much longer URL. But there's plenty of it about it online, and the archives for 30 of these so far that we've had are quite lengthy and complete. So you can look at the history of a lot of things there, including OAuth. OAuth itself kind of came out of there. An interesting thing about OAuth, and maybe we could talk to Kalia next time about this, is that I think what we had in mind at the beginning for OAuth is not exactly, I don't think anybody thought, which is we really need login with Facebook and login with Google as the way that this thing is going to get used. But there it was, you know, so an unintended consequence. Anyway, thanks so much, everybody. Thanks, Jonathan, for joining me this week. Next week, our guest is Tim Pozar, who's an old friend from the world of radio and was one of the pioneers in the ISP business, and is doing all kinds of interesting stuff. He's an alpha geek for hire and just a fun guy to talk to. So we look forward to that next week. So thanks so much. I'm Doc Searles, and see you next week.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and a rotating crew of Android journalists, developers, and enthusiasts, where we talk about the latest news, hardware, and apps for the Android faithful. You can subscribe by going to twit.tv/AAA or find the show in your podcatcher of choice. That's All About Android.